Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling, along with Leighton Kling. I'm joining you from Colorado this week. He's in California this week. And we've got three retail stories to talk about. We're also going to talk about my retail visits to Virginia as the show wears on. We'll begin the show with retail pharmacies. We'll also talk about closures and more closures. So it's going to be not necessarily a negative podcast, but there's a lot more closures on this podcast than ordinarily we talk about. I know there's a lot of talk in mainstream media about the retail apocalypse. We're not believers in that, but we do have to talk about a few of these things just to give you an overarching sense of where the world of retail was this past week. Now, a reminder, you can like us, rate us however you find us, whether that be on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Podcast Addict or any of those podcast listening services. You can also check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast. So we begin our show with the retail pharmacy realm. Two of the largest retail pharmacies were in the news this week, and they were going in different directions. Now, I mentioned largest retail pharmacies, businesses that focus directly on pharmacies. So we're not including Walmart, not including Kroger in this. We're talking, of course, about CVS and Walgreens. Now, CVS released earnings that beat estimates, while Walgreens, in rare fashion for this segment, announced even more store closures than the closures they've already mentioned. So this is really the first time we've seen larger scale store closures for either of these two chains. They've been commonplace with players like Rite Aid and Fred's, especially Fred's, however. But CVS, let's talk about them first because they are killing it with front store sales moving upward by an incredible margin over last year.
Yeah, that was something that surprised us. But also, many credited the Aetna acquisition directly with boosting the earnings over analyst estimates for this period, at least. Comparing earnings in this case is a little bit tricky, as CVS had a loss of $2.52 per share in the same quarter last year as a result of significant investments related to that very deal. Even still, analysts expected $1.69 per share in earnings. This was blitzed by CVS as they came in at around $1.89 per share. Sales also beat expectations, so that top line was definitely benefited by the Aetna acquisition. They came up with $63.43 billion versus the expected, again, this is an analyst figure, $62.63 billion. So a fairly substantial beat there. Again, this is up significantly over last year, around 35% up as a result of the Aetna acquisition. Now, looking at CVS a little bit more directly, sales from their pharmacy division grew 4.2%. This was mirrored by their retail pharmacy division, who had a previous revenue boost of 3.8%, independent, of course, of the Aetna acquisition. And this is really a result of inflation in brand name drugs, but was also, you know, due to some increased volume there. So a lot more people buying more prescriptions. Increased pharmacy volume is definitely something we've been seeing with major players in this space, even Rite Aid, which is surprising, but Rite Aid does still have a few strong markets they operate in. However, CVS's volume growth is approximately twice what the rest of the market is seeing. On that note, Trent, same-store sales grew a whopping 4.2% for them, but this time wasn't all just pharmacy. So we had already alluded to front-end sales there. Pharmacy did contribute 4.7%, but same-store sales for the front of the store increased a massive 2.9%. We say massive, you have to wonder, is that really a massive figure? Yes, it is, because the front-end sales for both CVS and Walgreens have more or less been stagnant over the last 2 to 3 years. This far outpaces any increase we've seen from them lately in the pharmacy segment, but this is a big win overall for CVS in the quarter. You have to really look at them and applaud their execution on the different initiatives that they've set forth. About 80 basis points of this came from the Easter shift into the second quarter. However, their front store sales would it still have been up by a larger margin than what we've seen in the past 5 years if you dismiss the Easter shift. And this is a huge win for their approximately 9,900 stores and suggests, Trent, that their increased pharmacy volume is parlaying itself into more front-end sales. And this is something that Walgreens has had trouble with in the past. And Trent, I'm, by the way, a customer of CVS. I go to a local CVS often to just to get cash back out of my debit card, but If you look at the volume of transactions that are happening based on just front of store sales, people are going into CVS's with or without pharmacy purchases as well. So that's very interesting in that they're able to promote lower price point items. You tend to think retail pharmacy is having a high markup on consumables. However, my local CVS has really good deals that compete with the likes of Target and Walmart. Again, just on a select few items, but nonetheless, you have to take those initiatives, those marketing campaigns into account. However, one piece of the negative news here is that their adjusted operating income declined 8.3% year over year. We have to mention that. This is in their retail segment. Much of this is due to expenditures and pharmacy margin compression overall. Something they are endeavoring to improve upon is their bottom line in the retail segment. They're wanting to reduce inventory, so this is one of the means to reduce that figure. And we see on the back end, not the front end, is how they're going to do it. They are aiming to reduce pharmacy inventory in stores by around $1.5 billion nationwide.
Now, strong categories for retail front store included beauty, which they say is capturing a larger share of wallet. They're seeing a lot of return customers for their beauty initiatives, and those customers are spending more. Big reason as to why those sales were up. However, they said more than any additional category, past store renovations that they've done. So renovations they've done in the last 5 years now beginning to pay off for the company. They found customers more willing to look at CVS as a retail destination after the renovations, and helping out incrementally are some of CVS's innovations within the store, something that we'll talk about a little bit later on with their health hubs. But they're finding that with that increased traffic comes increased front store expenditures by consumers, which is a major result in that bump. So once again, a lot of media outlets focused on the fact that the Easter shift was responsible for that front store sales bump. But again, you take that out and you're still seeing front of store sales up over 2%, which some analysts openly applauded on the Q&A on the call that we were on. Now, as far as CVS's initiatives go, there was a lot of concern, and perhaps there still is among pundits, that Amazon is poised to shrink market share. Now, CVS didn't necessarily mention Amazon by name on the call, but they do have a couple of initiatives that I think make it difficult for us to believe that Amazon is ready to be a prime player in this space anytime soon. And moreover, Amazon doesn't own a massive healthcare benefits company in Aetna, so it would be difficult to make too many inroads against CVS without some sort of an acquisition in this space on behalf of Amazon. However, CVS still remains on track to expand two programs that, as we mentioned, would seem to have a dulling effect on any of Amazon's ventures to capture market share in this place. First, they're expanding their CarePass program to the entirety of the U.S. Now, what this program is very similar to those programs like PillPack that you hear about. Program offers free home delivery of prescriptions for an annual fee. Aside from being a logical measure of prevention here against Amazon and against CVS, all about preaching prevention in the healthcare space, there are financial benefits to this program for CVS. Members of the CarePass program made 15 to 20% more purchases after joining CarePass than those who hadn't. So you're seeing, again, increase in expenditures, increase in volume, all of that setting up CVS for a good next decade. The second thing is CVS continues to roll out their health hubs. And again, these are called health hubs directly. It's not just colloquially termed health hubs. You'll actually see it marketed as such. This is similar to what Rite Aid has been focusing on. When you've heard us talk about Rite Aid in the past in the retail pharmacy space, they've mentioned a lot of in-store health services beyond pharmacy being a big focus. CVS, it's no different for them. CVS expects to have renovated around 1,500 total stores into these health hub locations by the conclusion of 2021. However, one thing I should mention is that growth could be slow here. So if you're out there, if you're shopping at a CVS, don't expect to see these health hubs pop up overnight. For example, they anticipate around 50 health hubs in four metro areas by the end of 2019. So we're only looking at four metros by the end of 2019. It's expected to grow to 14 metros by mid-2020, so about a year from now. And then the fastest growth for the program is between that point by mid-2020 and the end of 2021, where they anticipate much larger expansion. And by that point, you would figure they would have it down as far as not only expanding the program, getting the program out there, but maximum efficiency as far as not disrupting store operations, why that expansion is going on while that renovation is going on. And ideally, they'll have implementation down pat by that point as well. And honestly, Layton, this is something that Amazon just can't do. They don't have that brick and mortar presence in this space. They can't have those in-store clinics that the likes of CVS can. And I think that's why when you see a lot of these articles saying like Amazon is poised to rip market share away from CVS, and why when Amazon announces anything in the pharmacy space, you see CVS and Walgreens share price takes a hit. I think that's kind of short-sighted on behalf of some analysts, because CVS has so much going on above and beyond just the retail pharmacy section. And the Health Hub's initiatives, they say, have resulted in an incremental increase in front store sales as well as a result of a traffic increase there. All the more reason to remain bullish on their ability to win the race against other retail pharmacies over the next 3 to 5 years.
The interesting thing is, and they talked about this throughout the call, was how important their retail footprint was to their underlying business initiative. So everything that Trent has talked about is really directly affected by their overall footprint. Their store openings have outpaced store closures in the recent past, and they have done so this quarter as well, which brings us to Walgreens and Walgreens accelerating their what they call store optimization program. Typically, when we talk about store optimization programs on this podcast, we're talking about store closures or a significant amount of stores being closed strategically throughout the United States by a particular retailer. They try to label it a store optimization program to sound a little bit better than what the headlines may pick up. So, as we discussed in passing on the podcast previously, Walgreens had already announced plans to cut around 750 stores, partly due to the Rite Aid acquisition. They don't want to cannibalize their own stores. They want to optimize their footprint throughout the United States. The company said in the past that such measures were necessary to change the way they do business internally, and in particular, upgrades on technology as well. The additional cuts may amount to around 200 stores, bringing the total to around 950 stores of their current 9,560 stores, or right around 10% of their store base is what they're looking to cut, to put that in perspective. That's a lot of stores, Trent, a lot of stores throughout the United States that are going to be affected. And for reference, this is approximate to JCPenney's huge slew of closures over the past few years. And as an effort to cut costs with that company, has really not done a lot there. So hopefully with Walgreens, they're able to do what they're wanting to do, and that's reposition and look at their business in terms of financially trying to optimize their balance sheet and trying to make their customers familiarize with the maybe the best locations, again, strategically placed throughout the United States. What is surprising is that these closures are taking place in a growing retail segment. So this is something we've talked about oftentimes, and that retail pharmacy is here to stay. If we were long on one particular asset in the retail realm, it would be the retail pharmacy industry, and that there's going to be a lot more purchases with pharmaceuticals in the future, and one that even Walgreens has attempted to oligopolize over the past few years. One need look no further than Walgreens' acquisition of 1,932 stores from Rite Aid just over a year ago as evidence of this, really trying to take over the market share. It would be reasonable to believe that a number of the closures are as a result of these redundancies. As I have already mentioned, in these particular markets where Rite Aid has such a strong historical presence. However, this doesn't appear to be the reason here for a lot of these closures. The thing is, based on media quotes, it seems like a number of analysts are backing the move. They're basically saying that one step back equals two steps forward. Still, it isn't clear to us as to how closing these locations and incurring $2 billion worth of cost in order to do so will improve the technology at Walgreens. I had said that earlier, and you really have to wonder what exactly are they going to be funneling money into at these Walgreens locations, even if it's just in terms of long-term cost savings. Does the cost-benefit analysis really work itself out? One more question out there, by the way, at least for us, is what happens to the real estate? Real estate, always a huge topic on this podcast, something that Trent and I are both passionate about. Walgreens does have some locations in downtown or urban areas, but a vast amount of their locations are on street corners, hard corners, by the way, in suburbia or in small to mid-sized markets. And Walgreens and CVS both are notorious for signing very long leases. We're talking 15 to 20-year leases. Trent, I even saw one a few months ago for 25 years, meaning they're extremely bullish on whatever market they were serving there. But you look at these longer-term lease agreements, this means that a number of these stores will likely have to pay their way out of the term. If the lease agreement is set up in an appropriate fashion, they're going to have to pay the majority of that balance in a typical settlement. So there are going to likely be huge costs for Walgreens in this particular scenario. But above that, what happens to the actual hard asset left behind? What happens to the building, the land? To this point, commercial real estate owners have never really had a good answer to this question. And actually, anecdotally, I did see a Rite Aid that was recently closed, and this was part of the acquisition. So this is maybe a year ago. You're looking at this Rite Aid on a hard corner, ended up being a Dollar Tree that went into this particular location, but it was a smaller location than an average Walgreens location. So it really begs the question, what is truly going to be the best use for some of this real estate? It's often a buzzword for brokers out there. What is the best and highest use for this particular asset? For these hard corners, there's no doubt that the land is valuable. You have high traffic intersections. However, who beyond Walgreens or CVS is actually going to want to do business there? Let's say if there's already several convenience stores within that particular area. It really is a curious question, and I'm curious to see where these over 900 locations, what they really transform into in the future.
And I get it if these locations are in urban areas or downtown centers, but Walgreens, unlike Rite Aid, I was, as I mentioned, in Virginia just this last week. Rite Aid's got a number of locations in strip centers. Walgreens doesn't really have that. A lot of those Walgreens locations are freestanding on those hard corners, as you mentioned, so makes it a lot more difficult to repurpose the real estate into something once that Walgreens has left. So again, a lot of dynamics here, but Walgreens throwing away a lot of money by closing these locations. They seem to think it'll be cost savings for them in the long term, even if they incur, as I mentioned, about $2 billion worth of cost to close these locations to pay the rest of those leases in the short term. But again, just don't see what it has to do with improving the technology at the company, because CVS has had no problems improving their in-store presence, improving their technology, all while keeping locations open. And a lot of articles this week have mentioned that CVS is looking to close about 40 to 50 locations this year. That's true, but they're also opening over 100 locations this year. So again, with CVS, they're consistently adding, consistently seeking ways to improve their brick and mortar presence and move into better neighborhoods as far as where those expenditures are coming from in the pharmacy segment. So I think two retailers that are going different directions, and this is only a matter of time, because as we've said pretty much over the 4 years that we've been doing this podcast, CVS is beating Walgreens in this space. They're beating Walgreens in terms of PR. They're beating Walgreens in terms of their special initiatives. They're even beating Walgreens at the acquisition game. The Aetna acquisition was a big get for CVS. So in the future, what's Walgreens going to do to make up the ground they are quickly losing to their main rival? So 88% of financially successful people read at least 30 minutes per day. They're hungry for knowledge, they continuously seek self-improvement and learning every chance they get, and Blinkist gets you there faster than you can imagine. If you're like me, the list of books that you want to read or the ones that people suggest that I read is never ending, always expanding. I've talked about it before. I've got a pile of books next to my bed that are just waiting on me. I don't have time to read them all, but our sponsor, Blinkist, has solved that long list of must reads once and for all.
Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most impactful moments, so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes, all just from your phone. And with Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in just those 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anywhere. And Trent, personally, I like to listen to Blinkist while I'm at work or doing maybe some cardiovascular exercise while I'm at the gym. You're really trying to maximize the time, the amount of knowledge you can get with your free time. Like Trent said, not everyone has time to sit down and read a book.
The Blinkist library is absolutely massive. You've got Freakonomics in there. You've got Amazon bestsellers like Getting Things Done. My favorite, at least so far lately, has been Thinking Fast and Slow. I don't know that another book has influenced my decision-making and my thought process like that one has. That's an excellent one. Can't recommend that enough. So right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/retail to start your 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. You can cancel at any time. Again, that's Blinkist.com/retail. We go from Walgreens store closures to other store closures, more particularly Sears and Kmart, as Transform Holdco, or as it was on the top of their press release this week, Transform Co. announces closures of 26 total stores. We don't typically discuss Sears or Kmart closings on the show, especially over the last 3 years, because they've been so commonplace. We've kind of mentioned them in passing. However, a few important things that we wanted to discuss regarding this release. So I'll break down the details a little bit first. These closures are in much smaller number than their previous swaths of closures pre-bankruptcy. So only 26 stores on the dock. And I say only 26 stores, obviously it's very impactful for the staff at those stores, for those communities. But at the same time, we're used to seeing 50, 60, 100 stores closed in one fell swoop. Here, just 26. And 21 of the stores are Sears locations, 20 of which actually have those auto centers that will often also close. Auto centers, of course, for them have been in the news over the last couple of years because of their partnerships with online retailers. The auto centers will close earlier than the stores themselves in late August, with the rest of those stores closing around September or October. So this means that only 5 of the 26 locations are Kmart locations, which suggests, Layton, a completely different direction for Sears Holdings or Transform Co. in terms of store closures.
Yeah, this is a story I was excited to talk about a little bit because we always get nostalgic, but then also on the flip side of that, you get a little bit sad because you're talking about retailers that you grew up with. So with that said, we'll look into the details here. These closures are in much smaller number than their previous closures, the total absolute amount that is, with only 26 stores on the docket for this particular round. 21 of these stores are Sears locations, 20 of which having auto centers that will also close. And that was interesting, Trent, because usually that percent isn't quite so high. So if you're looking historically for maybe relevant purposes, only 15 to 20% of Sears had auto locations in the recent past that they've been closing. And it's a little bit interesting because we talk about real estate on this show, commercial real estate, and how closing an auto center may affect that piece of property. So for instance, I live by a very, very nice mall in the South Coast Plaza. While that mall is around 50 years old, it is beautiful, and they have constantly redeveloped that mall. A Sears recently went out of business maybe 2 years ago. They had an auto center, and they still really don't know what to do with it. You have this massive property, again, a property that attracts a very nice demographic, and yet here's the Sears auto center just sitting out in the lot, really just hanging out with pigeons. So you have to wonder how many of these will have the similar dynamic, but we've spoken anecdotally on the show about how Kmart's we visited in the past 6 months or so, about a dozen between the two of us, I think, Trent, seem to actually be turning in the right direction in terms of product mix and merchandising, store optimization. And we're not talking about store closures. We're talking about utilizing the right amount of square footage for the right product mix, with the store shelves being much fuller in certain areas of the store being closed off. It's not just anecdotal, but according to the company, the first paragraph of the closings release was about how the company has worked to return inventory levels to normal. And this is actually very, very smart for the company. You see areas of the store that aren't as full as others, but they're trying their best to make sure that their balance sheet is strong enough to sustain the future years. And perhaps this list of closings is reflective of the future of the company, or perhaps it is just coincidence or lease agreements are ending. But regardless, either way, most of these locations closing are less than optimal retail areas, particularly for Sears, Trent. If you look in these particular areas, you'll see that these closures in mid-sized Class C malls, maybe, and struggling retail areas in general, and also other places that are no longer hospitable to Sears overall. So there are a few exceptions. The Sears closure in the well-to-do Littleton, Colorado, and the college town of Athens, Georgia, do raise eyebrows, for example. Meanwhile, the Kmart locations include one Puerto Rico location, which we all saw that coming, let's be honest, which makes sense. They try to streamline their supply chain. You don't want a Kmart lingering in an area that you can't reach. And we talked about this a little bit on my trip to Hawaii, where I noted there were close to a half dozen Kmarts operating on that island for a long period of time. But as a company that's trying to reduce their cost, the logistics cost of doing business, you really want to make sure that you streamline operations, and that includes not having locations in far-off destinations. However, they also include two California locations in Desert Hot Springs and in Redlands. I was totally surprised by this, Trent. We had talked about this a little bit before recording, but I had looked these locations up when I got this list. Of course, we get retail news feeds like no other coming our way. And looking at these locations, I didn't even know they existed. And Desert Hot Springs, for those of you who don't know, is sort of a growing area. It's next to Palm Springs, a popular destination for those who want to get away outside of the Los Angeles metro area. Not really an area where people go to in terms of, let's say, a Las Vegas type destination. So if you live in Florida, you wouldn't really be wanting to go to Desert Hot Springs. But for the larger, most densely populated areas, it is sort of an area to go, and the housing prices are reasonable. Also, in Redlands, which is sort of on the outskirts of Riverside, California, totally surprised. I didn't even know there was a Kmart over there. I'm only about 45, 50 minutes away, so probably after recording this podcast, I will go visit that location. But this is interesting, Trent, because these locations, like I'm alluding to, are fairly strong in terms of population growth and in terms of just their overall economic condition. So they're doing well, and you have to scratch your head as to why they're closing these Kmarts. Why have they not been sustainable locations? Well, Desert Hot Springs, for one, or we call it the Desert Empire, has grown significantly in size over the past 20 years. So maybe this is a real estate play by Transform Co. So you look, Redlands, however, is not in the exact same position. But in any case, the notable thing from the press release is just how transparent the company is about their long-term goals. This is refreshing to us, again, as fans of the company that was. In the past, cutting stores was all about cost savings. Here, it sounds, Trent, more like a strategic pivot.
Yeah, I think whether we buy it or not, you know, that's tough to say, but it's at least good to hear them talking about store openings in a release. Specifically, they mentioned accelerating expansion of their small store formats. This includes, and I quote from the press release, opening additional Home and Life stores. Of course, we talked on the podcast a few months back about their endeavors to open 5 Home and Life stores. Sounds like they want to go even further into that category. And one of the other interesting things in the release, they mentioned the closings come as a result of, and again, I quote, differences with Sears Holdings over our purchase agreement, end quote. They also mentioned a generally weak retail environment, which is pretty consistent with what Eddie Lampert has mentioned in other press releases regarding closures. And again, we're critical of that because statistics, studies will show you retail sales are up. It just means that Sears and Kmart aren't getting that piece of the pie that they are up there. And they also reference the pending purchase of Sears Hometown stores, with that potential buyout adding to their overall store portfolio. So a lot going on here as far as the direction of the company. And I think it's fairly clear where they want to go with Sears. They want to go to the smaller format stores. They want to get away from clothing. That still leaves the question, what will happen with Kmart? Again, they're only closing 5 Kmart stores in this swath. Can they find a way to condense inventory in these stores and introduce co-tenants in stores like Kohl's has done in some of the same places in their partnership with Aldi? Will Kmarts eventually close entirely? You know, an argument could be made that there's still a place for retailers around 40,000 square feet in these type of markets. So we'll see if anything comes of this deal, of course, on the Kmart end of things. Again, like I mentioned, we know where Sears is going with it, but still a lot to be determined. And one thing they'd mentioned in their press release One thing that we've talked about a little bit is their willingness to add those Sears hometown stores under their banner. I feel like there's still a lot going on there as far as legal dealings before those stores can officially be folded in. So, again, as much of a looking ahead story as anything, but still, oddly enough, some positivity coming out of this release regarding closures of stores, which we don't see a whole lot.
So for our listeners out there, just a reminder, I am a bioaccelerator patient. I went to Medellin, Colombia about 4 or 5 weeks ago. I received active adult stem cells. The progress has been great. My knee feels better. My ankle feels better. They have a ton of new and really very, very innovative treatments there to treat a number of different conditions out there, anywhere from autoimmune disease or acute injuries. So for instance, if you tear maybe a tendon or something, you can go there, get active adult stem cells, and try to recover without the chronic pain or what some types of acute injuries can turn into. I will be tracking my progress and continue to give updates with the treatment that I received from BioAccelerator in Medellin, Colombia, giving the audience updates. I feel like I am healing. I am trying to overcome these injuries thanks to these stem cells. And Trent, to be honest with you, it was a great experience. It is extremely affordable. You just have to go online at their website to schedule an appointment, schedule a one-on-one talk session with the doctors there to get you started.
And that web address once again is stemcells.bioaccelerator.com/retail podcast. Again, stemcells.bioaccelerator.com/retail podcast. Wanted to use this opportunity on the podcast to go back to a semi-recurring segment we've had where each Leighton and I talk about a retail experience that we've had recently. And of course, I'll lead off in this case because I took a recent trip to Virginia. I went to Lynchburg, Virginia for the State Games of America. I was participating in the floorball event there. Now, our team finished sixth, which is respectable, but would have liked to have medaled in this case. Aside from that, that's one of the reasons why we didn't record a podcast last week is because I was busy sweating in a gym that was largely without air conditioning there in a bunch of goalie gear. But all that being said, my trip certainly yielded some interesting things as far as retail was concerned, and I did have just a little bit of time on the trip to visit some of the retail stores. Now, Lynchburg itself is kind of an interesting area. If you know anything about the history of Lynchburg, Virginia, and I didn't before I visited there, it was a kind of a center for eugenics. There were about 8,300 people that were sterilized in Lynchburg in the middle portion of the 20th century. So that's kind of an interesting part of the past. There's also the largest university in Virginia is located in Lynchburg, and it's Liberty University. It was, of course, founded by Jerry Falwell. But that university has kind of created this weird dichotomy in terms of the economy of the area. So what you have is Liberty University, which is a very well-to-do university. They've got a lot of fancy buildings on campus. They're a not-for-profit. They're one of the major employers in the area, and they pay fairly well. So you have the students, you have the employees of the university, typically coming from higher income backgrounds. And then you have kind of the rest of the city apart from that university. And almost twice as many people in Lynchburg are below the poverty line as in the rest of Virginia. So when we talk about Del Taco and kind of a barbell menu there, that's kind of what you see in terms of the retail landscape in Lynchburg. So you see a lot of off-price stores. Of course, Ollie's Bargain Outlet has a main center there. You see a lot of Burlington's and Ross's, that type of thing. You also see a lot of vacant retail space. So I found that part pretty interesting in Lynchburg. And then there are some upper-class boutiques that have moved to kind of the historic downtown that command a little bit of a higher price point. But aside from that, that's not really what I wanted to talk about here in terms of my retail experience in Virginia. I spent a large amount of time in Richmond because oftentimes when you go to Lynchburg, that's where you fly into and out of. We've talked about Richmond in the past on the podcast of having just an immense grocery presence. And it's interesting because Publix has just opened up some stores in Richmond. I actually went to an area just outside of Richmond where Publix had opened up two stores that were literally within a mile and a half of each other on the same road, basically in the same housing development. Above and beyond them, though, you've got Food Lion, you've got Kroger, you've got in the organic space, the Fresh Market, and Whole Foods. You've got Lidl opening a ton of stores there. You've got Aldi there as well. So just a number of retail grocers, and that's not to include a lot of the smaller neighborhood grocers. So there are a lot of thriftway type stores. There are a lot of other natural grocer type stores, a lot of local farm stands as well. So you look at this area and you really do wonder how on earth they can support so many grocers. And here's the thing. I honestly don't think Richmond can long term. There are just too many grocery stores there. As I was driving through Richmond, oftentimes you would count one every half mile or so, which is a far greater concentration than I've seen in most of my other travels throughout the country. And you might ask, well, Trent, if that's the case, then some of these grocers have to close down. Who's winning and who's losing the battle? Well, I think Aldi and Lidl are both winning the battle. You look at some of the new Aldi construction out there. You look at, of course, the new Lidl stores. Very fancy, very nice. The Fresh Market is kind of in between. They've, of course, struggled a little bit financially before their takeover about 3 or 4 years ago. But I think, honestly, the loser from all of this, and I didn't even mention Walmart. Walmart's got a massive presence there. But I think the loser out of all this is Food Lion. Food Lion stores, when you go out there, you know, a lot of the grocery stores, Publix is obviously, you know, big and bright. A lot of the new Kroger locations, the same thing. Big, bright stores, a lot of fresh food options. You go to Food Lion stores there, and they're kind of like dark and gloomy places, similar to what you would see if you were to go to, say, like a Thriftway in a town of about 3,000 people. So I found that very interesting, and that Old Delays, who is the, of course, operator of Food Lion, seems to be falling behind in most of the Food Lion locations. Are there renovated Food Lion locations there? Yep, you bet. But a lot of the major Food Lion locations that are in these residential areas are not renovated. And now they're finding themselves having to compete with Publix, with Kroger. And the other thing is Food Lion just cannot compete on price. Their prices on average were 10 to 20% higher than the Kroger stores and the Publix stores that I went to within the Richmond area. So I think that's a dynamic to watch for here. I think you're seeing a lot of grocery chains, kind of what we've talked about in the past with Albertsons and Safeway. How are they going to compete? Because they don't have a price proposition. They're starting to lose their convenience proposition as well. So the big question is, where are they going to compete? Overall, though, I was disappointed at the presence of Food Lion stores, which based on, you know, I've been to Food Lion stores about a decade prior, and they were kind of the crown jewels of this particular area of the country. Now, that's no longer the case. And with Publix making a push even further north, I think that's going to squeeze Food Lion and some of these other smaller grocers as well, kind of out of the grocery picture in areas like Richmond. Well, now that I've soliloquized so much about grocery in Richmond, Virginia, a topic that maybe five of our listeners care about, our final news story isn't so much a news story, but a suggestion that perhaps retail real estate holders should tie into retailers' finances more closely. Now, this idea, which made the rounds of retail media this week, stems from bank PJ Solomon's discussions with some mall owners about potentially extending financing to Forever 21. It's no secret that Forever 21 is struggling. They have been said to be on the verge of a potential bankruptcy. And PJ Solomon and others have approached these mall owners and operators about potentially converting rent and maybe some other liabilities there into secured debt that would give Forever 21 and companies like them a little bit of breathing room. Now, the benefit, in theory, for the mall owners and operators is that they would keep these stores operational, they would keep traffic coming to the malls or stores like Forever 21, and they wouldn't have to fill the vacant spaces. Of course, the downside is, if you're a mall owner or operator, there's a major question as to whether you will ever see a return on this investment if you're just basically giving up these rent funds as a form of secured debt. So, Leighton, there's a lot of dynamics going on here with this particular story. I know you're tied in very closely with the retail real estate industry here. So what's it come down to for retail real estate holders?
Yeah, I think it definitely is a larger cost-benefit analysis. But if you're looking at things at a more micro level, I think you touched on what I would be first looking at, which is capital allocation. So, for instance, if you're the mall owner, let's say you're a REIT and you have several B and C class malls throughout the country, and you want to, for whatever reason, hold on to these assets for the next 10 to 15 years, is your money better spent? Are your efforts better spent trying to finance with these retailers to make them a little bit more sustainable throughout the duration of your ownership period versus perhaps spending money on revitalizing the mall itself to make it more attractive for future tenants. So it's sort of a give and take, and not everything's going to be a known. There's a lot of variables here, a lot of unknown variables as well. So in the future, I would look at a lot of these malls and say that, you know what, if they're B or B plus malls or maybe B minus malls, they have a Forever 21 in them and they already have decent occupancy, let's say 85% and above, then maybe this is a situation on a case-by-case basis that you would want to maybe help live a little bit longer. You would want them to be a little bit healthier. We're talking about the retailer here. We would want to help them. We would want to partner with them so that they're financially viable and their balance sheet is strong for the next few years. And I think in the case of Forever 21, not all of their locations are going to be in the best areas of the United States. In fact, I think they made a mistake when they expanded too quickly. And I think Trent made a very, very good remark about this about 12 months ago on this very podcast, saying that Forever 21 may have gotten ahead of themselves in terms of their very large, aggressive expansion throughout the United States. So with that said, I think there are some malls they should be in and some malls they should not be in. However, if you're looking to help Forever 21 as a business, you really need to look at what is changing with them fundamentally. So you can't just give them a lifeline of cash. Again, allocate funds that could be, again, opportunity costs in another realm of your business if you're the landlord, and just hope that they're going to be able to sustain their business. Because at the end of the day, Trent, Forever 21 can still file bankruptcy if their financial progress has not been making the leaps and bounds that it should. So I think that it would behoove the landlords here and the banks. We're talking about the boutique bank of PJ Solomon in this particular case. It would behoove them to look at the situation in a pragmatic fashion and say, you know what? What are our risks if Forever 21 does go bankrupt? Now, however, if they go bankrupt, they are entitled to a lot more of their assets if they're financially intertwined versus just being a landlord. That is an objective case to really go forward with some sort of transaction that instills a return on your investment, at least to that degree, if Forever 21, for instance, goes bankrupt. But a lot of scenarios we've seen have just not worked out. One that we'll talk about here has worked out a little bit, and that's Aeropostale. A lot of our listeners may remember they actually went bankrupt or filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy on May 4th of 2016. We talked about it on the podcast, and we talked extensively about how they ended up being bought out in September of 2016 after a $243 million bid from several different groups. We're talking Authentic Brands Group, and then also Mall Operators and Simon Property Group and General Growth Properties, which of course has gotten bought out since then. But you look at that transaction, well, it was a deal between the landlord and the retailer. Aeropostale had a massive presence in U.S. malls, in a variety of classes of malls, and the deal ended up working out. While they had around 800 stores at their peak just prior to 2016, Aeropostale did, they still have around 400 stores throughout the United States. And a lot of those stores, and this is mostly anecdotal, I actually went to an Aeropostale around 2 weeks ago. They're doing well. They're doing well. Well enough to stay in business. So in that particular deal, it worked out. And with Forever 21, Trent, they have good traffic. They have a popular brand. Again, I think it was just a function of expanding a little bit too quickly, getting ahead of themselves in terms of how strong they thought their brand was. But for Aeropostale, it's worked. Since January of 2017, again, they've had close to around 400 stores that are active throughout the United States. That was working. Their debt structure has apparently worked, and we don't really see any cracks in the armor so far of their balance sheet. So I think at the end of the day, it is a case-by-case basis, but as a landlord, it is your fiduciary duty to do whatever it takes to be able to keep traffic levels up in your particular mall. And we talk all the time about occupancy externality. What does that mean? That means that if your mall is empty, no one's going to be coming. The more retailers you have, the more people you have in that mall. And guess what? Those retail tenants, those businesses, they look at the other tenants that surround them. Forever 21, believe it or not, is still an attractive brand if you're another retailer looking to occupy a mall setting. So All in all, you have a lot of different things to take into consideration, but I think this could be, in this case that we're talking about here, a decent deal for all parties.
I think ultimately, though, it comes down to the landowners or the REITs here having held on to some of their properties a little bit too long. We look at some of the property owners like Kimco, for example, applauding them for getting out from under a lot of these BNC properties before this became an issue. Because let's face it, if Forever 21's in an A-class mall, some of the high-end malls here in the U.S., they go out of business, you may not have an issue filling that in. If you own an A-class mall and you're a landlord, you should be able to find someone that can pop right in there. A lot of the A-class malls in the country, and we've talked about this with some REITs earning calls, you're looking at occupancy rates in the 97 to 98% range, which means that there is likely demand for those spaces there. If you own a B or C class mall, that's probably not going to be the case. So I think Leighton has a good point for potentially eating the rent. But I think one other thing that Leighton fell on is that, again, this is secured debt that they'd be reaching out to them with. So if you're a landlord, this might be your best opportunity to say, hey, maybe we can get something out of a bankruptcy settlement versus just having to eat the rest of the lease if someone declares bankruptcy and gets out from under the lease. So a lot of different factors here, but ultimately, I got to place the blame on some of these mall landlords that are holding on to these B and C class properties that are in this position in the first place. We talked about your fiduciary duty as far as the property as a whole, and Leighton was very good to mention the externality of these things. But at the same time, if you're a REIT and you've stayed on top of things, as many REITs have done, you're not holding on to some of these properties that are in dire straits of potentially having your occupancy eaten away at if a retailer like Forever 21 goes out of business. So I think there's a lot of different dynamics here. Ultimately, though, it's kind of interesting because a lot of Forever 21 stores during that expansion started taking on larger and larger square footage locations. And I think first what Forever 21 should probably look at, or these owners of the malls should probably look at, is decreasing Forever 21's footprint if at all possible. There are a lot of two-story, for example, Forever 21s in certain A-class malls saying, hey, maybe can you go down to this one story here? We'll work with you on those lease terms so that we can fill in that other portion as a way of kind of hedging our bets because we don't think you're very secure financially and we also don't think you need this much space. So a lot of things going on here, but it's been made clear that at least in the mall space, there's a little more room for negotiation versus some of those contracts like we mentioned Walgreens walking into where they're signing 20 or 25 year deals, and those are pretty much going to be set in stone.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
That brings us to the conclusion of the Retail Focus podcast with a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a look at a story that we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year, and we begin with Leighton.
My looking ahead has to do with a company that I actually have ownership in, and regrettably so. JCPenney on Thursday said that they actually received formal notification from the New York Stock Exchange, the exchange in which their stock is listed, that they are no longer in compliance with the listing items. So, for instance, if your stock is below $1 for 30 straight days, you are no longer in compliance with the different requirements that are from the New York Stock Exchange. And this is interesting, Trent, because this comes as the company has been hurdled with over $4 billion of long-term debt. We were talking about 12 months ago saying that we were hopeful personally, and a lot of other analysts were hopeful that they could start to significantly pay down that debt. However, their operations haven't created enough cash to do so. Hence, a few poor quarters and the debt not being paid off. Therefore, a lot of people that are investors in the company, myself included, are considering to sell, bringing down the stock price. It now is more or less a supply and demand issue with that stock dynamic. So the stock has fallen to all-time lows here in the recent couple of months. And if you look, Trent, if they stay at those sustained levels, they could be delisted. And that doesn't mean they just automatically file bankruptcy. That has nothing to do with bankruptcy. It just means that they would have to be on a different exchange. And I think overall, you're looking at a company that has a lot of issues. This is one more of them that they have to funnel energy and attention into, and it's going to take away from their core business. So I think the company, a lot of changes in the executive suite over the past year. They have a new CEO. They have a brand new CFO, which we had talked about on the podcast as well. Between all of those things, they have to figure out how to make their company a little bit more attractive, at least in the short to midterm, to investors, to maybe elevate that price of one share of stock. And again, I'm a shareholder. I bought a modest amount of shares maybe 2-3 years ago. I thought that there was a not necessarily a massive turnaround in place, but I thought that they could pay down debt, and I thought that they could, in fact, remain profitable, because we've seen several times very modestly profitable quarters from the company. But I have to say, Trent, I really don't have renewed faith in this company, this institution, if you will, for as long as it's been around. We can say that it's a retail legacy institution, and I just don't see a bright future for the company. I'm going to go ahead and hold on to the shares because, you know what, Trent? They're basically worth nothing. So nothing divided by nothing is nothing. So I might as well see where this story ends and play at least one small part in the larger picture.
Yeah, and I gotta admit, it's kind of fun to have like all the bankruptcy notices that you get as a final shareholder. I was a final shareholder in Alco when they declared bankruptcy, and so I still have a lot of those old bankruptcy notices and some of the certificates that came along with that there, just because I'm a retail nerd. But yeah, I think all JCPenney has to do is release a press release that has Amazon in the top line, and their share price will go up at least for a day. So that's kind of what we've seen here, is how ridiculous sometimes the stock market landscape can be. My looking ahead story is regarding Foot Locker. So we talked in our prior story about how Forever 21 is occupying some larger square footage locations and maybe they need in certain malls. Well, Foot Locker is continued to open what they're calling power stores, and a few of them have been in the news this week. So they've got one that just opened in New York this morning, actually, as we're recording the podcast on Saturday, August 10th, in the Washington Heights neighborhood of Manhattan. Square footage, 9,000. They've also opened one in Detroit and two in Philadelphia. This store that they've opened, 9,000 square feet. So 4 to 5 times larger, sometimes 3 times larger than their mall presence stores are concerned, and some of their outdoor stores, their strip center stores, are concerned. But the reason this has hit the news is because Nike has partnered with Foot Locker very closely. We talked about how on their last earnings release, Foot Locker didn't really mention Under Armour as a brand that had momentum around it, but Nike was one of the first brands mentioned. And here, Foot Locker partnering with Nike. Nike's brought some of their proprietary technology into this store. This is the first time that Nike has actually done that. Nike's loyalty members can get different benefits for shopping at this particular store. The reason I'm looking ahead, though, is, you know, you've got these four stores here. They can probably work. They're looking to open over 50 of these power stores over the next 3 years. My question is, first, can they find the appropriate real estate in order to do so? Because some of these areas are tough to find real estate in for 9,000 to 10,000 square feet stores. The second is, can these stores legitimately be profitable? We know Foot Locker's mainline stores are profitable. They've done a fairly good job over the last couple of years of maintaining a spot in the marketplace. Do these power stores make sense in an era where stores are decreasing square footage? Foot Locker is actually going the other way. An interesting call for them and their leadership. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Again, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast, and we'll be back with you about a week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.